And it's a big challenge for us because, you know, if a company is really going to at some point take off and show the sort of growth levels that are exciting for the VC community, you do need to invest and you do need to know how to raise capital. That's a skill that the founders need to have. And so it is a red flag for me if something is like 100% bootstrapped, because there's a big question mark. Like, are you guys actually able to raise capital?
Welcome to the SaaS Revolution Show, a podcast by SaaSDoc. Here we interview SaaS founders from around the world who've been there and done that. They share the ins and outs of how they built their businesses, their operations, their path to securing investment, and more. Our mission with the podcast is to help you, the founder, learn how to scale your SaaS, maintain your well-being, and navigate the complexities of this ever-changing industry. I'm your host, Alex Dima, and together we'll explore the good, the bad, and the ugly in the journey to SaaS success.
All right, welcome back to the SaaS Revolution Show. I am your host, Alex Dima, CEO and founder of SaaSDoc. And today, I am delighted to be joined by Denis Motilov, who's a managing partner of Venture Debt at Flashpoint. Welcome, Denis.
Alex, thanks for having me. Good to see you.
Great to have you on the podcast for the first time. Obviously, we've been friends with Flashpoint for a number of years, been coming to SaaSDoc conferences, met a lot of the team there, had a few glasses of wine even as well at some of the speaker dinners and so on and so forth. But Denis, we would love to start the show as always, but just getting to know you a little bit more. So let's start with that. And the question, who is Denis Motilov?
Yeah, look, thanks. And looking forward to, I guess, more glasses of wine later this year as well at various occasions. As you mentioned, I'm the managing partner at Flashpoint, responsible for the venture debt product. In terms of a little bit of, I guess, background, I'm not actually a typical venture guy in the sense that I joined the sector when I joined Flashpoint, or the industry, if you will, which was about 3.5 years ago now. And I've had quite a few different twists and turns, and we can sort of talk about this a bit more later, but I started off my kind of life, my corporate life as an actuary. So I thought that, I'm a fairly numerical guy. What's there to do? I looked up kind of the list of who gets paid a lot of money, and actuaries were pretty high on that list. And I said, sure. So I spent about 5 or 6 years doing that. Then I went into private equity, and I spent about 14 years, and I'm dating myself a bit here. So if you add all that up, so I spent the next kind of 14, 15 years doing private equity. And then, somebody told me that career cycles go in 7-year chunks. And so I guess that's what I did. I had my first 7-year chunk as an actuary. Then I had sort of two chunks in private equity. And then I decided to completely sort of change tack, and I joined Flashpoint. In terms of kind of how I think and what it's like to work with me and how I look at life generally, I think the one thing that I would say is, my kind of fundamental, I suppose, North Star is sort of truth seeking, I would say. So, this is what drives me, is to understand things, understand how things work, put patterns together. And in that sense, it's helpful to have had a few different career paths. As I said, I'm pretty numerical. And I think I'm fairly good at kind of putting big picture patterns together. And I'm also good at the detail, but I'm pretty bad at like the middle part of sort of turning all that, going from one to the other. So that's something I guess I work on day to day as a personal challenge. So that's a long-winded answer, mate, to who is Denis, but there you go.
And is that, I know you're based in London, right?
In Zurich at the moment.
You're in Zurich, okay, at the moment. But I'm detecting an Australian twang there, Denis. Did you leave that bit out?
There's a twang, mate. Yeah. There's a bit of Australia there. That's where I grew up. So I guess as you can tell by the name, I was born in Moscow, but my parents moved to Australia when I was pretty young. I was about 11. And then I grew up there. And I spent half of my career there. And then at the age of 30, I left again. One of the other interesting things, and this is something that I would actually recommend to people, and it gives you good perspective, is I started my career in Sydney, and I spent quite a bit of time there. Then I moved to London for a couple of years. Then I moved back to Moscow for a few more years, then London again, and now Zurich. And so I've lived and worked in four different places, in four different cities, and quite different cities as well. And this is sort of not a sabbatical or you know, like an assignment for 6 months. This is, you know, living and working in a particular place and becoming kind of, you know, embedded into that place, both work-wise and socially. It does give a lot of perspective, which I think is very, very handy generally. And so that's one of the benefits, I suppose, of having moved around. And yeah, so this twang is Australian. And there's a lot of debate about what the accent is, actually. Like, I don't actually know. I don't actually know what accent I have anymore.
I think it's overwhelmingly Australian, but I don't know. But overwhelmingly, but muted. A quick one there. So obviously you've lived and worked in a few cities. Like, is there a favourite one, and why? And what one thing do you miss the most about Australia?
Yeah, look, a favourite one is difficult because they all have kind of very, very nice things about them. Sydney is probably the only place in the world that you can have a very nice job in the financial sector. So it's got a very well-developed financial system because of the pension system there. But where you can go for a surf, you know, after work or before work. I'm pretty sure that's the only like financial center in the world that allows you to do that. So that's a big benefit of that. And, you know, it's hard to beat that just in terms of life quality, to be honest. London obviously is, you know, massive city. Like there's no point going on about that. Moscow is very similar but very different to London at the same time. So that's kind of where my heart and soul is. But in terms of working there, it's a bit of a different story. And Zurich, I guess, where I landed now, the highlights are just everything works. But the lowlight is it is the most expensive city in the world. So no matter where I travel, it's like I've gone discount shopping. No matter where I go from here.
Very good. Well, thanks for sharing that. And so Flashpoint, so you mentioned there's both venture debt, you know, and venture capital on there. And perhaps we can do a quick distinction on what those are. But how long has Flashpoint been around? You know, how many funds, any interesting, which I know there are, but, you know, companies that have been invested in or taken venture debt, maybe a little bit of background around that.
Yeah, sure. So Flashpoint's been around for about 10 years. And it was started by a couple of guys who, and this is, I guess, not an atypical story. A couple of guys who got fed up with investment banking and thought that they'd do something more interesting. And so Flashpoint was first launched as a pure VC house. So early stage VC, late seed, early Series A rounds. At first it was kind of friends and family money, and the founders had to put in, you know, half of the capital themselves. So this was, you know, talking about alignment of interests. And from that sort of humble beginning, grew a business that's got about $500 million under management today. It's got three product lines. So aside from this VC line, which is still obviously, that's probably the core of the business. Flashpoint's now in its fourth fund for the VC business. We're now into our second fund for venture debt. So this is, you know, we can go into the distinction, you know, in a second. And then we also have a secondaries product. So direct secondaries fund, which whose purpose is to buy out early seed investors, angels in I guess companies that have reached a certain amount of or a certain size or scale and are probably not too far away for an exit. So that's kind of the overview. As I said, you know, it's seven funds under management now. You know, we've done kind of, you know, 60, 70 transactions, you know, 18 exits. But the one distinguishing feature about our funds, I guess, is that we are quite active in returning money to LPs. So, you know, we've returned over 130 million of capital to LPs. And, you know, in terms of highlights, I guess, look, we've chess.com was a big one for us. You know, God bless the Queen's Gambit that made a few people rich in the Flashpoint kind of family and LP base. But we also invested in Shazam. We invested in Guesty more recently, which is currently kind of a growth round. So these are, I guess, highlights. And, you know, we talked about funny stories before, and I was trying to think of a funny story. And, you know, there's actually not too much since I've joined Flashpoint, but I've been asking people around for anything that they would share. And the name, I guess, is one thing that people came back with. And they actually wanted to name a company after like some sort of mountain peak, you know. And it's like, it's not uncommon. Like there's like Stone Peak and there's this peak and that peak and Everest and this and that. And I think they figured out that most of the like cool ones were already taken. And then the idea for Flashpoint was simply, you know, like in chemistry, Flashpoint is, you know, the point at which something ignites. And we thought, okay, well, you know, capital plus our knowledge, we ignite the founders. And so after sort of searching for mountains, we landed on something that's completely, completely different from that, and thought that was a great idea and went with that. So not that funny, but you know, I'll keep working on that part of my routine. Yeah.
No, but interesting nonetheless. And actually, you say, despite all these years of knowing Flashpoint, but a question that I've not asked, and I didn't know the story. So good to share, and it makes a lot of sense. So yeah, no, thanks for that. And also, like so, some very interesting companies there as well. And on the secondaries product, is this like a relatively new product, not only for Flashpoint but in the market? Just from my side, actually, it's probably the third time in a week that I've spoken to like a growth fund that also talks about the secondaries product. But actually, sort of prior to that, I wasn't really you know aware that there were these kind of products. Although I was aware that you know founders and companies and you know investors would do secondaries. So maybe just quickly on that, is it new? Is it just something that I've just not really heard of? You know as much.
Yeah. Look, to be honest, I think it's been around for a while as a concept. I mean, as long as there have been, you know, closed-ended funds or illiquid funds, there's always been a desire for some sort of liquidity that people have. And as long as there have been private companies, there's been a secondaries market for shares in those companies. In terms of putting like an institutional framework around it and having like as an investment class, look, I've come into contact with various types of these funds over the years. In private equity, it's quite common. There are funds that specialize in buying out kind of fund stakes. So, you know, in a lot of situations, you might have a situation where a fund, for example, is not performing. LPs have, you know, kind of tuned out and lost interest. The managers also lost interest. And so secondaries funds can come in and make something of that situation. And then direct secondaries is what Flashpoint does. It's not buying kind of fund LP stakes. It's buying stakes in companies. That's also, I think, been around. I think the attention it's been getting more recently is that, you know, obviously in a less favorable macro kind of environment, there might be more opportunities in that segment. So I think a few people are trying to start that kind of business up. And you could say similar things about venture debt as well. So like venture debt is also a product that's getting more attention now for similar reasons, right? Because when things are going great and equity is cheap, well, equity kind of rules. But when things don't go as well and equity becomes expensive and people need liquidity, that's when other things sort of come to the fore. So yeah, I'm not surprised that you're hearing more. But I think it's as a concept, it's kind of been around for a while.
Cool. And before we go into, let's say, the main topic today, where I think we're going to discuss and hear from you that from a founder's perspective, what is out there if you don't really want to dilute. Maybe just a observation, but can you just share a little bit around the state of venture debt at the moment, why this matters for SaaS founders?
Yeah. And again, I guess a general caveat to the whole conversation is what I said earlier is that, you know, I'm not like a two decade venture guy. I'm relatively new, but for what it's worth, I'll give my two cents. And I guess the thing I can add is perspective in other kind of financial asset class sectors as well, because I still see what's happening in there. So I think generally when you have a time like this, where, yeah, obviously interest rates going up is the key driver of change in the financial system, right? This causes like a chain reaction and a seismic change in how people allocate their assets. And so when that happens, like fundraising across the board becomes more difficult. Like cash, especially for private, for private markets, it does become more scarce, you know, for a number of reasons, which we don't really sort of need to go into, but, you know, that is just a fact. And that's been a fact for the last 2 years, I think. And so not just in VC, but also in private equity as well. And when that happens, there's a general flight to brand, I think, that happens. And so if you're a big brand, you know, you can still walk in, you know, to a pension fund's office and then you can still raise money because that pension fund has maybe less allocation to give away and therefore less scope to take a chance on new managers. And you have to understand that, like, the macro environment, it hits throughout the system. And so people, you know, worry more about, you know, their jobs and their performance. And so everybody is more cautious. And so nobody's been fired for, you know, giving money to, you know, Sequoia before or, you know, or to KKR. But, you know, people have, you know, if you take a chance today and lose money on taking a chance for a new manager, that's not going to be a good thing. So my perspective is it's a flight to brand, which means that fundraising for big names is okay. But fundraising for new products, even if it's big names or for, you know, up and coming names, it's not as easy. That's for sure. So this is, I guess, on, and when I say fundraising, I guess I talk as a fund manager, but it's, you know, it has a follow on effect to companies as well. So, you know, there's less money in the system. There's like a smaller spread of VC firms that are willing to back companies and take chances. And so the founders, you know, they feel the same, not the same pain, but a similar kind of pain where just the sources of capital have been restricted for them.
It trickles down, right?
Exactly.
It's more difficult to raise new funds. It's more difficult to raise funds, certainly in the growth sector, it seems, than actually like early stage at the moment. Would welcome some comments on that. And then, therefore, whilst these VCs may have some significant size funds that they've raised maybe, you know, a couple of years back, either a lot of them are sitting on that and deploying it kind of slower, or because they're perhaps raising smaller, newer funds or struggling, you know, with those additional funds that they're raising. So there's less money in the market right now, and therefore less capital for startups to raise. But it does seem to be hardest in the growth sector, or growth stage right now. So why is that?
Yeah, look, that's the correct observation. I think at the early stage, it's less institutionalized, and this is sort of my sense. I don't have maybe as much insight as other people, but my sense is that it's less institutionalized and it's less, and the amounts are smaller. So, you know, if you want to raise like a 3 million seed round or, you know, 5 million, you know, a Series A round, like there's lots of options, you know, aside from going to like a big VC. You can raise that from, you know, from family office, high net worths, and, you know, friends and family that you might have, right? If you're looking for like a 30 million ticket, you know, that's a different universe, and that's where you might have kind of more dichotomy emerging between kind of, you know, the people that are able to raise and the people that are not able to raise. And so the people that are less able to raise do have to keep these reserves for their portfolios rather than doing something new. And so there's more of a, you know, there's more of a caution about where you, you know, what new bets you place versus supporting your existing companies, I think, at that level in particular. But it also affects the low end as well. I mean, we do see, as you said, less impacted, and you know, things are, you know, relatively, I would say, interesting and robust at kind of, you know, Series A and at that sort of stage. But certainly at like, you know, 30 million kind of ticket size, there's that effect.
And there also seems to be, and I guess last point on this, you talked about the VCs are holding on to more money so that they've got to follow on for their portfolio companies, right? So they can invest in them first rather than investing in the new businesses. And then what I've seen a lot are these like seed extension rounds instead of going to Series A. There's a lot of seed extension rounds, like for instance. And then the investors who are investing in the seed extension are typically the lead investor on the seed, you know, and then perhaps some new other investors to kind of help with that. Is like a seed, I know you're more on the venture debt side, but would you just see this is just kind of commonplace and actually not a negative signal at the moment? Or is that, are these kind of extension rounds and just follow-ons from the existing VCs a slight negative signal in that they don't quite have the metrics to get to that next round, and so therefore they're just kind of backing the company so that they can stay alive.
I mean, it's a positive signal that they're able to get money. For me, and again, this is probably my venture debt hat coming on, a company finding a new investor is always a great thing. A company that continues to raise from an existing investor is a good thing versus not being able to raise at all. And so we see extension rounds generally across the board, you know, whereas, you know, again, if you rewind 2 or 3 years, you know, finding a new lead was not as difficult. Today, you know, most rounds that we come across, you know, there's a large component of kind of existing investors leading it in doing CLAs or something similar.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, let's jump into the topic around dilution, right? And especially if founders do not want to dilute, which I think was probably, I don't know, I'm sure there must be surveys out there, but you know, when you're starting a business, and most typically, I guess, kind of with co-founders, you're splitting the pool, you know, two ways, three ways. You know, there are solo founders out there that own 100% of the business. And I've seen a number of, WhatsApp channels that I'm in and groups that I'm in where the founder, it's like, oh, I've got 100% of the business, but, you know, I don't know whether to like give some to my team or whether I give some to the new co-founder. So there always seems to be a little bit of this resistance to dilution, even, you know, with those specific cases. But then there's obviously this kind of path that or thought that, look, if you really want to scale, you're likely going to have to do that with a lot of capital and resources, and therefore you're likely going to have to dilute. What are the options that if you want to scale and you don't want to dilute, like talk us through that and let's learn a little bit about that.
Yeah, I guess the first thing on kind of what you said, and again, you know, I'm sure there are people that can talk about this much more authoritatively than I can, but, you know, there is kind of the optimal path, I think, that a company, you know, that has the right product can take, because being overly cautious or overly conservative about dilution means that you kind of miss out. There's opportunity cost to that. You can't grow as quickly. At the same time, if you give, you know, too much away, you know, incoming VCs or investors are going to ask you what your incentive is and why, you know, why you're still interested in this whole thing. So, like, dilution in itself is not a bad thing. I think you have to trade it for growth so that, you know, your overall skin in the game and value goes up and everybody benefits from that. And so I'm not advocating not diluting. You know, we do talk to companies and where, you know, that are, you know, 100% or 90% owned by the founders and are not necessarily VC backed, and it's a big challenge for us because, you know, if a company is really going to at some point take off and show the sort of growth levels that, you know, that are exciting for the VC community, you do need to invest and you do need to know how to raise capital, and that's a skill that the founders need to have. And so it is a red flag for me if something is like 100%, you know, bootstrapped, because there's a big question mark. Like, are you guys actually able to raise capital? The reason I thought dilution and sort of what you can do is a good topic, though, is because obviously today, you know, valuations are such that, you know, it does get painful in a lot of cases for people. So, you know, you have down rounds, you have flat rounds, and even if you have kind of CLAs, you have kind of leak prefs that are, you know, punishing for early investors. And so, If you're an angel or an early investor, or, you know, you don't have too much firepower to keep putting money into the company today, this is a big topic for you. You know, you're not going to be too happy if, you know, if there's a round which is very painful for you. And there's a founder as well. I mean, a founder is in a slightly different situation because there's ESOPs and other instruments that you can use to, you know, to sort of get a bit of that back. But, you know, you also don't want to kind of get, you know, down to, you know, 7% of the company you started 2 years ago, 3 years ago, because the market is bad. And so I think today we have a lot of conversations generally with people coming to us and to Flashpoint and to my team specifically about, you know, we need to raise money. We have good support from our investors, but, you know, valuations are a problem, or I guess some people would call them rational. Some people would say it's low. And we want to have something that limits dilution, right? And so, what can people do? You know, as a startup that's still loss making, that's still going through a growth phase. And then, like, there are a few things that spring, like, where does money come from for these companies? And there are a few things that spring to mind. You know, convertibles. Well, it's still equity. It's still dilute. It's still going to dilute you, you know, in a year's time. So that doesn't really solve the problem. And typically that's, you know, you still have to put up with lick prefs and terms that are, it's probably going to dilute you more because there's a discount. You have various debt instruments that are not dilutive. And your access to them really depends on the sort of business that you are. And this is where I think it gets interesting. And I think it gets interesting because a lot of founders may not come from a background that kind of understand various sources of capital, right? And so this is, I think, why it's a good topic to have. So venture debt is obviously one of them. And venture debt, I think, is, you know, I wouldn't call it an umbrella term because there are various parts of it. But it is, I would say, the most flexible, you know, broadly speaking, non-dilutive capital that you can have. Right. If you compare it to other options, for example, you know, there's sort of revenue financing for e-commerce businesses. That's available. And that's, you know, that's not dilutive, but it's bloody expensive, right? Like it's sort of presented in a way, it's like a royalty, right? It's a percentage of your revenue that you have to give away until it's paid back. So that's a risky and expensive. And it's not flexible. It only is available to certain types of businesses, right? If you happen to have assets that are, you know, kind of bankable, then you can get asset-backed debt. That's always a good solution. But, you know, in order to have those assets, you have to have bought them at some point before. So you've sort of sunk a lot of money into it. So I kind of see this as freeing up capital rather than bringing in new capital. But, you know, if you have property or if you have, you know, some businesses, for example, like fintech lenders, they have a loan book. You can borrow against the loan book. Or you can borrow against inventory. You know, assets can be borrowed against, and that's a good source of capital for companies that are able to tap it, because it's generally cheaper than alternatives. You have to pledge your assets, but you know that it's non-dilutive and it's relatively, you know, sort of cheap and readily available and easily done. So I would encourage people to think about that as well if they can, if that's available. Look into government subsidies. You know, a lot of the companies in our portfolio have managed to secure loans during COVID, you know, for example, that are like extremely favorable, you know, in terms of cost and tenor and flexibility. So, you know, and a lot of times they're not even senior, like they're not even secured properly. So as a founder, you know, to the extent that there's this government support that's available to you in terms of subsidies or cheap loans for various programs, I would really look into that because you can get, you know, you can get some interesting opportunities there. But coming back to venture debt, I think that's, you know, there's shareholder loans, also kind of like equity. But venture debt is really kind of the systematic way of approaching this problem. And so it's not for everybody, because you need to have a certain set of characteristics in order to be able to get venture debt. You know, you do need to be VC backed, for example. In our, like the sort of things we look for, you know, you need to have a certain amount of revenue, sort of at least 3 million ARR, kind of traction, unit economics, all of that. But if you have a genuinely sort of, if you genuinely have a business that is firing, that has traction, you're selling your product, you know, there's demand, product market fit is there, and you need sort of firepower to grow. And today that money is more expensive, I think it's a no-brainer to use debt or venture debt, because yeah, you the benefit you will get from that funding is going to far outweigh the cost of it, particularly given how expensive equity is today. So this is sort of my, I guess, monologue. And maybe I'm biased because this is sort of the product I'm in. But really, and you know, the reflection of this, I think, is again the pipeline that we see today, and where, you know, 2 years ago, if you've got a great business that's firing on all cylinders, like I said, and you just need funds to grow, it's just so much easier to just go and get cheap equity. Like, I get it. People would say, well, why do I want to run a process with you? You know, there's three more documents I have to like go through and hire lawyers for, and it's going to take me 2 months, and like, why don't I just like sign a 2-page safe or something and get another 5 million at a valuation of 20 times revenue? Like, sure. If that's how much it costs, then sure. But today I think it's a very different story. And today I think debt is sort of super, super interesting. And it's not just like, I mean, this is the other thing I wanted to mention. It's not just pure growth. You know, you mentioned secondaries today. Like it's a symptom of the fact that, you know, there is movement in the market. It's not just about funding growth. It's also about buying and selling. It's M&A. It's rolling up players that are tired and just want to exit, right? And one of the things that we fund as venture debt is also kind of M&A plays. So if you're a business and you want to take advantage of this market and buy competitors, this is also something that's easily debt funded. And, you know, why would you spend equity on that? So there's lots of different ways to use it for your benefit. And like I said, I think it's, of all those options, it's the most flexible, I would say, and you know, what's the right word? General purpose, I guess, is the other word. Flexible and general purpose loan that you can take that doesn't dilute you.
So if you're, thanks for that, and really kind of helps the clarification, and I would it be fair then, let's say if you're under 3 million, that, you know, the avenues that are best suited for you would be things like convertibles, asset-backed debt, factoring, government subsidies. Over 3 million is probably, when you look at revenue-based financing, which you also said is very expensive, or venture debt as being that other option.
Look, I think so. I think because for venture debt, in the way that we do it, and at any rate, we do like to see traction, right? And we need to have enough data to understand that the engine of the business is firing, which is, you know, the unit economics makes sense, you know, the company's capital efficiency. And so until you get to that kind of level, it's a little bit sparse, you know, like it's a bit hard to do the analysis when you know, based on kind of, you know, 6 months of something. And you know, so as a rule of thumb, we say kind of 3 million, you know, obviously, but the fundamental principle is that, you know, debt providers, including ourselves, we have to kind of credit assess a company. It's not just a question of the founder's great vision and he's charismatic and, you know, the market is interesting. You know, we kind of look at numbers, and for numbers, you need to have, you know, a bit of time and a bit of a track record.
I really thought you were talking to me there when you said the founder was charismatic and, you know, the market was interesting, but forgot we had the audience. But conscious of time, Dennis, we're going to move on into the quickish fire round. So let me ask you, what one thing has moved the needle the most for you in your career?
I've said before that I'm not like a career VC guy. And so for me, career has been sort of a winding path. You know, it's not been a straight line. And so it's difficult to say for me, like, what's one thing that's really gotten me like a promotion and like what's made me, you know, become a partner or a managing director or whatever. The sort of advice I would give, you know, is the times that I felt I've grown the most and ultimately benefited were the really tough times. And so don't be afraid to take tough projects where you're not sure that you're going to succeed, right? If you just take the easier stuff, you know, it might be good in the short term and you might get a, you know, a good bonus, but at the end, you will just, you know, you will not have as much depth and you know, to your experience. So I think the fact that I have taken on some winding routes and taken on difficult things, not always succeeded, but, you know, learned along the way, that I wouldn't change about my career.
What about the best advice you've ever received?
Look, and this is not career related, but, you know, to find my person and start a family. So this is to my wife and my kid. That's the best thing in my life for sure.
Who gave you that advice?
That's from my mother, obviously. This is somebody who, you know, didn't see the benefit of this until kind of maybe later in life. And this is something that she's always told me, is that, you know, once it happens, you'll know. And that's very true. So I would definitely, you know, recommend to people that, you know, having a family is just adds another perspective to your life for sure. And that's the best thing that you can do.
What about the biggest failure you've made and lesson learned?
Look, biggest failures probably, and this goes to kind of my personality a bit, is missed opportunities, I would say, because I one feature that I have that I've always kind of struggled with is I can be a bit inertia carried, if that's a word. So if things are kind of going well and things are okay, I don't constantly sit there and say, what else can I do? What else can I do? Which is why I'm not a startup founder, you know, because that's what you kind of, you need to be as a startup founder, somebody who's constantly, you know, trying to change something and do something. And so when I think about the failures, you know, it's not sort of not succeeding in some assignment. It's more, you know, there could have been a lot of interesting things that I could have done that I just, you know, slept through, shall we say. So I would encourage people to, you know, to be proactive about it, to sort of take things and run with them and see where it gets you.
What about the hardest thing for founders, like raising in this market?
Well, look, it's just a hard market to raise in, I think. So I would just say, look, it is a cycle. You know, and like any cycle, if you're in this cycle and it's more difficult than you thought, you just got to keep going. Just find ways, just hustle, scramble, find ways to get through, because it'll end, it'll turn, and the ones that hustled and scrambled at the end will benefit. And just one more thought on that, and this is like goes again to what I said before, and make quick decisions. You know, like be ruthless. Like if you need to cut costs, just cut costs and survive. That's the number one thing.
No, that's very, very sound advice. What about last one on the quick fire round? Your favorite book on business and why?
There's lots of business books. It's hard to pick a favorite from them, and there's always new ones coming out. So I'm not going to say, you know, Elon Musk biography or whatever. I will say Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I think it's very relevant today, much more relevant than it has been in a long time. And so for people who care about kind of merit and doing a good job and doing the right thing in an environment that kind of values other things, I would highly recommend reading that.
Yeah, so I still never read it, but I'm going to put it back on
It's a bloody dictionary, mate, so like, I don't blame you. It's taken me months to read it, but you know, I think it's worth it.
You're there. All right, I'm going to give it a go. So I know Flashpoint will be back at SASOC in Dublin in October. It's some time away. We probably haven't really got into what we're talking about yet, but looking forward to having you guys back there, and you know, can't wait to be back in Dublin and getting the SaaS community, investors, founders together again. In the meantime, obviously October is a while away. If people wanted to reach out to you, Dennis, where can they find you online? Also Flashpoint.
I mean, look, Flashpoint VC, you can find us, you know, on our website. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm not that difficult to find. It's just my name, Dennis Mosolov. So get in touch. Always happy to chat. If you have ideas or if you want to share, you know, some thoughts, you know, just drop me a line. If you're in Zurich, drop me a line and we'll go for a coffee.
Expensive coffee.
Eight francs for a Starbucks.
Yeah. It's a lot. Well, Dennis, thank you so much for being a great guest on the SaaS Revolution show today. Really appreciate it. Enjoyed speaking with you and looking forward to seeing you and the team in October at SaaSOC in Dublin, but I'm sure we'll see each other before then. Thank you so much, Dennis Mosolov, Managing Partner at Flashpoint Venture.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of the SaaS Revolution show. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you learned something from it, check out sasdoc.com/events to find all the upcoming SaaSDoc conferences around the world.
Want exclusive SaaS content and actionable insights to grow your SaaS? Join our community of over 36,000 SaaS founders at sasdoc.com.